destination. The U.S. has spared no effort in creating a deep feeling of hatred towards it amongst Iranians.
Iran's post-revolution history can be summed up as such. It was an effort for freedom and independence. The idea was these goals could be achieved by depending on republicanism and Islamism in the face of an American effort to hold Iran back as a country at the service of the West. Students' Day symbolizes the opposition between these two forces. The latter, that's the American effort, certainly doesn't seem party-based. That's to say U.S. foreign policy towards Iran is the same in essence with both U.S. Democrats and Republicans in power. Because U.S. foreign policymakers have not yet realized Iran's strategic significance in the region, and so they don't stop talking of reining in this country. Maximum pressure sanctions, the U.S. expected, would cause a rift between Iranians and their government. But what happened soon after with many Iranians was that whatever rift may have started, U.S. sanctions only stitched up. Because those sanctions were as harsh as an economic war on this country, and wars only unite a nation from top to bottom. And that'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do join us again at the same times next week. Bye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Several Palestinian political prisoners have been on hunger strikes in the Zionist regime's jails for more than 100 days as they protest against their administrative detention and harsh prison conditions. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mustafa Abu Sunayne, journalist. This article is published under the heading Palestinian Prisoners' Hunger Strike Against Detention Reaches 100 Days. Stay tuned for more. Meghdad al-Ghawasmi and Kayed al-Fasfus have been on hunger strike for over 100 days, protesting their imprisonment without charges or trial by the Zionist regime. Several Palestinian political prisoners have been on hunger strikes in the Zionist regime's jails for more than 100 days, as they protest against their administrative detention and harsh prison conditions. Meghdad al-Ghawasmi, a 24-year-old Palestinian from Al-Khalil City, has been on hunger strike for 103 days, protesting his administrative detention, a form of imprisonment without charge or trial imposed by the Zionist regime. The highly controversial policy used almost exclusively against Palestinians allows for detention without charge or trial for renewable periods of 3 to 6 months without the possibility of appeal or knowing what accusations are being leveled against the detained. Many Palestinian prisoners have resorted to hunger strikes to protest against the policy. In October, Gawasmi was admitted to the intensive care unit in Kaplan Medical Center following a deterioration in his health condition. His mother said then that his limbs are as cold as ice with a pale face. Gawasmi has been arrested several times by the Israeli regime since 2015 and has spent 4 years in Israeli regime jails. His last arrest was in January from the city of Al-Khalil, south of the occupied West Bank. The university student has launched a hunger strike in the summer after the Zionist regime renewed his administrative detention. In October, the Zionist regime froze Gawasmi's administrative detention but did not eliminate it. Gawasmi's family and his lawyer said that the Israeli regime decision meant that he was detained in the hospital instead of prison. Jawad Balous, Gawasmi's lawyer, said Israeli regime prison service, IPS, and Shin Bet, the internal intelligence, have turned Gawasmi into an unofficial prisoner in a hospital watched by security guards, and that the Israeli regime will disclaim any responsibility for Gawasmi's life and destiny. Though Gawasmi could receive visits in the hospital under heavy security presence, his family still cannot move him to his home, despite the Israeli regime decision to freeze his administrative detention, according to his lawyer. Kayed Al-Fasfous, a 32-year-old from Dura village near Al-Khalil, has been on hunger strike for 110 days in protest against the Israeli regime administrative detention. Fasfous has said that he will not cease his hunger strike until he is released to his home. The Palestinian Prisoners Society said recently that the Israeli regime had issued a new 6-month administrative detention sentence against Fasfous recently. It added that Fasfous is currently being hospitalized in Barzilai Medical Center and he suffers from body pain, fatigue, and emaciation, and his memory is getting weaker. B'Tselem, an Israeli group documenting human rights abuses against Palestinians, said in October that Fasfous faces an immediate risk to his life. Fasfous, a bodybuilding champion in Dura and an avid sportsman, has lost 40 kilograms in weight since he launched his hunger strike on July 15th. Khaled, his brother, told B'Tselem that none of the family members is allowed to visit him. Fasfous had also been arrested 3 times in the past by the Israeli regime and was held for 5 years in Israeli regime jails. Ever since I was growing up, our family has never been whole, Khaled, his brother, said, adding, we have never all gathered together around the dinner table. One of us is always locked up by the Israeli regime. There are 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli regime jails, 544 of them serving administrative detention. Other Palestinian prisoners who launched hunger strikes against their administrative detention are Ala Al-Araj, who has been without food for 85 days. Hisham Abu Hawash has been on hunger strike for 76 days. Shadi Abu Akbar for 69 days, and Ayad Al-Harimi for 40 days. Loy Al-Ashqar and Ratib Hubirat launched a hunger strike last month in solidarity with other prisoners for 22 days and 24 days subsequently.
理解people。
American Free Fall。
U.S. President Joe Biden admits that the U.S. is falling far behind other countries in infrastructure and child care. Meanwhile, it's spending 40% of the world's entire expenditure on defense on its military.
History shows that no country stayed on top forever. 100, 200 years is the max, and then they peak and go into decline. So I presume we're no different from anybody else. But one of the problems with history is people don't learn the lessons of history. You know, we had a president recently who didn't know history. If he did know history, he said he was smarter than history. I know I'm not smarter than history, and history is very clear. No nation and no currency, by the way, because they sometimes go hand in hand, has stayed on top forever. So America is now the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. We have troops in over 100 countries. There are people who would say that we're overextended financially, economically, militarily, and it looks like they might be right. So, I worry. It's not a good time to be young in America, because what the young people are going to inherit is mind-boggling.
Hello and welcome everyone to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And in this episode, we'll discuss Joe Biden's economic proposals and how he acknowledges that the U.S. is not in a suitable position anymore. We'll also speak about the reasons of the U.S. decline and reiterate how massive spending on the military is taking its toll on other segments of the country. Stay tuned.
The rest of the world is starting to out-educate us. Early education is earlier and more prevalent in European countries. A significant number of, we rank number 34 out of 37 industrial nations in the world, and the number of where we rank in terms of people getting a degree beyond high school.
Now, Joe Biden had also said a few days before the previous announcement that the U.S. infrastructure has fallen from the best in the world and now ranks 13th in the world, and America is also behind in investing in early childhood education and care. Biden has stressed that the world is catching up and beginning to pass us. Our first guest is Dr. William Black, the professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and also a lawyer and author. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you for the invitation. It's good to speak again with you.
Now, Dr. Black, tell us, so why is America falling behind the rest of the planet?
Because the United States, if it were a race, would be the one riding the 12-year-old horse with bad teeth and going, well, you know, it keeps getting me around the track. Why do I need to worry whether I'm at the front of the pack or the back of the pack? In other words, we haven't tried. And if you don't try, you fall farther and farther behind.
Thank you for joining us, Professor Black from the state of Missouri.
It seems that the problems in the United States are far more severe than Biden is letting on. For example, a report from the Harvard School of Public Health revealed in 2019 that more than 40% of schools in America that sampled their water turned up that their water contains too much lead. This is while most are not even testing for it. The report goes on to state that there is no safe level of lead and that it causes irreversible nerve damage and permanently damages the brains of babies and children.
The economy is, first, it's never been this way, so it's, from an economic perspective, unknown. What I mean by that is these supply chain shortages and bottlenecks, we've never seen anything like them. And what the world went to over the last 30 years is called just-in-time inventory, which means there's very little extra inventory. And so if there is a shortage, it can shut things down very rapidly. And then people bid up the price because it's so short. And so you're seeing these particular areas of inflation, but also particular areas where you can't, for example, build a car unless you have all the components. And so if even one necessary component isn't there, it's going to slow down production. At the same time that's happening, we have record numbers of people that regained employment over the last 8 months. So, you know, the economy is complicated.
Now, 2 years later, a report showed that 91% of Pennsylvania schools that tested drinking water found lead, but only 9% removed it. In climate change, Biden is facing mounting pressure from environmental activists to pass a bill to help reverse climate change. But the bill is not only opposed by the Republicans, but also from some Democrats, like Joe Manchin III.
Manchin, who is a senior U.S. senator from West Virginia, is also a businessman whose interests include founding the coal brokerage Enter Systems and has made millions of dollars from his coal company. Now, the coal industry may be hurt by the bill, which tries to reduce gas emissions. This is while at the same time, U.S. power plants are on track to burn 23% more coal this year, which is the first increase since 2013.
The whole idea that when you have a sovereign currency, you fund things through taxation is not correct. But you are also correct that the extreme rich in the United States are taxed after the Trump tax cuts in particular, but even before, at an exceptionally low rate compared to many countries. And during the pandemic, they have added over $3 trillion in wealth to a very tiny number of families, less than 1,000 have added over $3 trillion in wealth.
So Joe Biden is trying to pass legislation for his domestic agenda. The Build Back Better budget reconciliation bill is one of two huge pieces of legislation. The other bill is focused on infrastructure. Build Back Better focuses on a list of social policies, from education to healthcare, from housing to climate. The program includes publicly funded preschool programs, free community college for 2 years, expanded Medicare services and Medicaid, lower prescription drug costs, housing investments, tax cuts for electric vehicles, and other climate incentives. Our second guest is Mike Harris, journalist and commentator. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, Mr. Harris, tell us, U.S. infrastructure, it's in shambles. Why?
On the matter of why our infrastructure is falling behind, that's plain and simple. That is simple corruption. There's so much theft and pandering and malfeasance on the part of our government officials, where they're not doing the jobs that they're paid to do. There may be a contract for a bridge go out or for a highway project go out or something, and they try to seek the lowest bidder. A lot of times, when you get the lowest bidder, you get the lowest quality. And they've been neglecting these projects for years and years and years. Our bridges are falling apart. Our airports are falling apart.
Thank you for joining us on our program, Mr. Mike Harris.
The bill does not include universal health care or any provisions for student loan debt forgiveness. The average student loan debt owed in the U.S. is $37,693. There are also no additional increases in Social Security, federal assistance for the poor, elderly, and disabled either. The cost of these bills are supposed to be covered by new tax plans, but with the opposition of two Democratic senators, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Sinema of Arizona, the fate of these bills are unknown. The bill would cost $3.5 trillion over 10 years. Manchin and Sinema want a much smaller cost. Manchin had suggested $1.5 trillion. The White House and Democrats are trying to decrease the costs so they would be able to pass the bill by the end of October.
Very strong policy reasons for taxing people in terms of quality in that sense. And this is where you have to remember how narrow the margin is. In other words, it's tied in the Senate between Democrats and Republicans, And in our system, for most purposes, that means the vice president could break the tie, and the vice president, of course, is a Democrat. But if that means every single Democratic senator has a veto power over this kind of legislation, and two of our Democratic senators are exercising that veto power, and they are exceptionally protective of the extreme wealthy.
A recent piece in The Hill, that's a U.S. media outlet out of the Capitol there, explains that the cost of the legislation for small businesses and ordinary Americans are too real, and that it would be paid for by the biggest tax increases in generations. According to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, over 1.4 million small businesses employing almost 13 million Americans would pay higher taxes and would see it rise by 26%. Now, small companies structured as pass-throughs would see their access to the 20% small business tax reduction plan dramatically curtailed and would face other tax hikes.
California has a 51 cent per gallon gasoline tax. Arizona, my state, has a 19 cents a gallon gasoline tax. New York has a 27 cents a gallon gasoline tax. Where does this money go? No one seems to know. It's supposed to go to improve the highways and the roads and bridges, and yet every year the roads and bridges are worse and worse. So there is no accountability, and I blame it on corruption within our government and failure to act on the behest of the American people and protecting their best interests. Instead, these politicians line their pockets. We see so many politicians who come into office with very, very little money, and they retire as multimillionaires. How is this possible? It's flat-out corruption in the U.S. system. That's plain and simple.
Now, while the government is scrambling to pass these bills, a Pew Research Center poll found that from July to September, Biden's approval rating fell by 18 points among black voters, 16 points among Hispanics, and 12 points among women. He won all three groups with high margins last year. His approval ratings among Democrats fell by 13 points, and his approval among independents that contributed significantly to his election fell from 54 to 42%.
Look at poverty, and let's be straight here. You know, we look at the war on poverty that was initiated by President Lyndon Johnson in 1965. We've spent since then, as of 2015, $23 trillion on the war on poverty, and yet there's more poverty than ever in this country. It's a number of things. One of them is that these programs that they have, you know, the welfare programs, the welfare system, how the system is constructed, is not effective. It hasn't been effective at all. What the Democrat Party primarily has done with this policy is to build themselves a poverty constituency that will always vote for the Democrats because they will support increases in welfare and other poverty programs. These programs plain don't work, and they never have. You compound this and make it worse by what Bill Clinton did by passing NAFTA, GATT, letting China in the WTO. When U.S. jobs were offshored, we were promised by Mr. Clinton that whenever he did these things, that we were going to replace those low-wage, dirty manufacturing jobs with high-wage knowledge worker jobs. Here we are 20-plus years later, and those knowledge worker jobs still have not yet appeared.
Experts believe that the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the COVID pandemic, and Democratic infighting over Joe Biden's domestic agenda are the main reasons for his colossal setback. 92% of African-American voters had voted for Biden in the 2020 election, but now only 67% of them actually approve of his job.
Two of these Democrats in the Senate want to wreak havoc on the Biden agenda in particular. And so, for example, the Democrats are talking up the fact that the bill would reduce childhood poverty by half, which is, of course, a very good thing. But the obvious question is, who would design a bill that would leave half the children in poverty? And these two senators don't want to take even half of the children of America out of poverty. So that's quite insane. And that's those would be the primary effects in the two areas of child and health care and in terms of dealing with global climate disruption.
Okay, so as the opposition grows over the cost of Joe Biden's main legislation, the U.S. spends trillions of dollars to invade other countries throughout the world and keep its military bases abroad while its own country is suffering from poverty, homelessness, unemployment, a broken down infrastructure, and cannot seem to find a way to pay for the people's needs except by increasing taxes.
Because the U.S. primarily works on a military economy. We have never stopped being on a wartime economy since World War II. You can witness this with the war in Korea. We didn't win. The war in Vietnam, we didn't win. Afghanistan and Iraq, we didn't win. The military needs more money every year because they're beholden to the military contractors and shareholders. These contractors need ongoing state of war, and they need more money every year to increase their profits and their bottom line in order to appease their shareholders so that they can get their bonuses and that. We have a revolving door. Generals and colonels leave the military and go directly to work for the military contractors afterwards. That is why the military every year consumes more and more money.
The American people, especially in the African American and Hispanic communities, are suffering from much needed investment, especially with the rise of unemployment due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The health system in the country is crumbling, and ordinary people are not able to afford health care. The minorities in the U.S. are the ones who are dying disproportionately from COVID-19.
The U.S. has corruption that is rampant, and the system is not sustainable. We're essentially run by a criminal enterprise at this point in time. Any vestiges of our Constitution have been stripped away. The lobbyists, the money that's spent on that, the way campaigns are financed, all of it. It truly is a tragedy what has been allowed to happen to the United States.
Now, the U.S. defense budget this year is more than $700 billion, which is almost 40% of all military spending in the world and more than the budget of the highest spending 11 countries after the U.S. combined. Now, the budget has increased throughout the years, and the voice of critics has gone unheard.
We have our controlled news media in the country. Back whenever Ronald Reagan was president, he deregulated telecom. And at that time, we had over 153 independent news outlets, media outlets. That is consolidated down to six. And those six are all marching in lockstep. They all have the same message all the time. That is why you don't see the outrage, because the news media does not emphasize what's going on.
According to the Washington Post, in 2019, America's military budget is set to grow for a fifth consecutive year to near historic highs in 2020, as lawmakers push increases in defense spending for next year, despite opposition from some liberals in Congress and deficit hawks.
At the time now, the Democrats wanted a smaller increase, but regardless, the U.S. is now spending more on its military than at any point since the Second World War, except for just a few years on the high point of the war on Iraq. It is interesting that despite the massive spending, a 2018 report by the Pentagon in connection with the White House stated that all facets of the manufacturing and defense industrial base are currently under threat and claimed that some entire industries within the military supply chain are near extinction.
Would the U.S. be better off spending less money on the military? Absolutely. And again, I go back to the military contractors and how they do business. The U.S. spends 10 times more than the next five countries combined annually on the military. And we don't have the largest military as far as number of people, but we do have the most expensive weapon systems. And many of these weapon systems simply do not perform to standard. The Russians, on the contrary, spend 10% of what the U.S. does on weapons platforms, and their stuff is state-of-the-art. It's highly functional. It works better than anything the U.S. will generate. They overcomplicate things by design because these require constant upgrades, constant maintenance, and that's a revenue stream for these military-industrial contractors. The Raytheons, the Boeings, the Northrop Grummans, the Bath Shipyards, all of those people that profit off of our military. And it has become, like I said before, the U.S. is based on a military, on a wartime economy. And that's why these things are there, so to keep the profitability of these defense contracts.
The United States is losing the wars and destructions it has caused around the world. The most recent example is Afghanistan, that left them no other choice than to retreat.
We need regime change in the U.S. We need a complete new set of governing people and governing principles. The U.S. has sold itself out. Greed has taken over. The politicians are for sale. The defense contracts are for sale. The lobbyists make their money by persuading politicians to do things that are not in the interest of the American people. And that really seems to be the number one reason why the U.S. is failing, not just in those areas, but in every area. We are, at this point in time, failing as a country. This is just a tip of the iceberg. The American people, we don't trust anything.
Some domestic critics of overspending in the military say that by cutting military costs, America could fund a universal child care policy, extend health insurance to the millions of Americans who lack it, and provide significant investments in the country's infrastructure without increasing taxes on ordinary citizens.
The FBI, which was originally put together to investigate bank robberies, now is the greatest sponsor of domestic terrorism. They have turned toxic against the United States. The same could be said for the CIA, which is supposed to be an intelligence gathering network overseas. CIA is active in this country, working against American citizens. Same for the NSA. All of our systems have turned into a command and control system against the American people to extract as much money out of us as possible without inciting a revolution organization at this point in time. And the criminals have tightened their control over every facet of the American government, and the American government is tightening its control over every facet of American life. And so when we say we are a free country, freedom is only an illusion in this country. You're not free in this country anymore.
This is unlikely to happen, however, because the U.S. has to first stop meddling in the affairs of other nations, nations whose corrupt officials and representatives fail to put national interests above their own. U.S. politicians earn a great deal of money both themselves and through their election campaigns from arms companies, which makes it that much harder to imagine that without enough pressure from the public, they would ever abandon the business of killing people abroad anytime soon. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Do join us again next week on another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The so-called global war on terror was not confined to operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. The U.S. now has counterterrorism operations in 85 countries. We prepared for you an article written by Netta Crawford, professor of political science and department chairwoman at Boston University in the United States. The piece is titled Calculating the Real Costs of the Afghanistan War. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. The United States invaded Afghanistan in late 2001 to supposedly destroy al-Qaeda, remove the Taliban from power, and remake the nation. On 30th of August 2021, the U.S. completed a pullout of occupation troops from Afghanistan, providing an uncertain punctuation mark to two decades of conflict. For the past 11 years, I have closely followed the post-9/11 conflicts for the Costs of War project, an initiative that brings together more than 50 scholars, physicians, and legal and human rights experts to provide an account of the human, economic, budgetary, and political costs of the Afghanistan war, and also the consequences of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Of course, by themselves, figures can never give a complete picture of what happened and what it means, but they can help put this war in perspective. The 20 numbers highlighted in boldface below, some drawn from figures released on Wednesday, 1st of September, by Cost of War Project, help tell the story of the Afghanistan War. From 2001 to 2021, on 18th of September 2001, the U.S. House of Representatives voted 420-1, and the Senate voted 98-0 to authorize the United States to go to war, not just in Afghanistan, but in an open-ended commitment against those responsible for the recent attacks launched against the United States. U.S. Representative Barbara Lee of California cast the only vote opposed to the war. In other words, the U.S. Congress took 7 days after the suspicious 9/11 attacks to deliberate on the authorization of the war. At 7,262 days from the final attack on Afghanistan to the final troop pullout, Afghanistan is said to be the United States' longest war. But it isn't. The U.S. has not officially ended the Korean War, and U.S. operations in Vietnam, which began in the mid-1950s and included the declared war from 1965 to 1975, also rival Afghanistan in longevity. U.S. President George W. Bush told members of Congress in a joint session on 20th of September 2001 that the war would be global, overt and covert, and could last a very long time. He said, "Our war on terror begins with al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped and defeated. Americans should not expect one battle, but a lengthy campaign, unlike any other we have ever seen." The U.S. started bombing Afghanistan a few weeks later. The Taliban surrendered in Kandahar on 9th of December 2001. The U.S. began to fight them again in earnest in March of 2002. In April of 2002, George W. Bush promised to help bring true peace to Afghanistan. "Peace will be achieved by helping Afghanistan develop its own stable government, Peace will be achieved by helping Afghanistan train and develop its own national army. And peace will be achieved through an education system for boys and girls which works. The so-called global war on terror was not confined to operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. The U.S. now has counterterrorism operations in at least 85 countries. The human cost. Most Afghans alive today were not born when the U.S. war in Afghanistan began. The median age in Afghanistan is just 18.4 years, including their country's war with the Soviet Union from 1979 to 1989 and civil war in the 1990s. Most Afghans have lived under nearly continuous war. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, there are 980,000 U.S. Afghanistan war veterans. Of these men and women, 507,000 served in both Afghanistan and Iraq. As of mid-August 2021, 20,722 members of the U.S. military had been wounded in action in Afghanistan, not including the 18 who were injured in the attack by Daesh terrorists outside Kabul airport on 26th of August. Of the veterans who were injured and lost a limb in the post-9/11 wars, many lost more than one. According to Dr. Paul Pasquina of the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, of these veterans, about 40% to 60% also sustained a brain injury. Because of some of the lessons learned and the innovations that have taken place on the battlefield, we were taking care of service members who in previous conflicts would have died. In fact, because of advances in trauma care, more than 90% of all soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq who were injured in the field survived. Many of the seriously injured survived wounds that in the past might have killed them. In all, 2,455 U.S. service members were killed in the Afghanistan war. The figure includes 13 U.S. troops who were killed by Daesh terrorists at Kabul airport attack on 26th of August 2021. U.S. deaths in Operation Enduring Freedom also include 130 service members who died in other locations besides Afghanistan, including at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, in Djibouti, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Jordan, Kenya, Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan, the Philippines, Seychelles, Sudan, Tajikistan, Turkey, Uzbekistan, and Yemen. The United States has paid $100,000 in a death gratuity to the survivors of each of the service members killed in the Afghanistan war, totaling $245.5 million. More than 46,000 civilians have been killed by all sides in the Afghanistan conflict. These are the direct deaths from bombs, bullets, blasts, and fire. According to the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, thousands more have been injured in the Afghanistan war. And while the number of Afghans leaving the country has increased in recent weeks, more than 2.2 million displaced Afghans were living in the Islamic Republic of Iran and Pakistan at the end of 2020. The United Nations Refugee Agency reported recently that since the start of last year, more than 558,000 people have been internally displaced, having fled their homes to escape violence in Afghanistan. According to the United Nations, in 2021, about a third of people remaining in Afghanistan are malnourished. About half of all children under the age of 5 years have experienced malnutrition. The human toll also includes the hundreds of Pakistani civilians who were killed in more than 400 U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan since 2004. Those drone strikes happened as the U.S. sought to kill Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders who fled and sheltered in Pakistan in late 2001 after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Pakistani civilians have also been killed in crossfire during fighting between militants and the Pakistani military. The financial cost. In terms of the U.S. federal budget, the Congress has allocated a bit over $1 trillion to the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, for the Afghanistan war. But all told, the war has cost much more than that, including the Department of Defense, the Pentagon spending. More than $2.3 trillion has been spent so far, including increases to the Pentagon's base military budget due to the fighting. U.S. State Department spending on to reconstruct Afghanistan and train its military, interest on borrowing to pay for the war in Afghanistan, and spending for veterans and the Veterans Affairs system. The total cost so far for all post-9/11 war veterans' disability and medical care costs are about $465 billion through fiscal year 2022. And this doesn't include the future costs of all of the post-9/11 veterans' medical and disability care, which Harvard University scholar Linda Bilmes estimates will likely add about $2 trillion to the overall cost of care for American veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars between now and 2050. The war in Afghanistan, like many other wars before it, began with optimistic assessments of a quick victory and a promise to rebuild at the war's end. Despite George W. Bush's warning of a lengthy campaign, few thought that that would mean decades of war. But here we are 20 years later, the United States is still counting the costs of the Afghan war.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip marked the 104th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. They also expressed their anger towards the British government and its continued support to the Israeli regime. In 1917, then British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour issued his declaration giving Zionists the permission to usurp Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration led to the displacement of the indigenous Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime in 1948. Hamas movement vowed to continue resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The Palestinian people are still suffering from the repercussions of the ill-fated Balfour Declaration, which created a Zionist entity on holy Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration will be trampled upon by the Palestinian people. After 104 years, we maintain that all form of resistance will be used to liberate all of the historic land of Palestine.
Palestinian refugees, who make up most of Gaza's population, demanded compensation from the British government for the pain and suffering for more than 7 decades.
We want to liberate the land of Palestine and return to the towns and villages from which we were expelled. The Zionists have no rights here and have no place in our land.
The United Kingdom, along with the United States, have been the strongest supporters of the Israeli regime. Senior Palestinian officials demanded that the British government must compensate Palestinians for the grave pain and loss.
Britain has started our misery, and the United States has taken it upon itself to continue this injustice by supporting the Zionist occupation and giving it the green light to violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Both Britain and the United States have been making attempts to turn the Israeli regime into a military superpower.
104 years on, the Balfour Declaration continues to plague all aspects of life for Palestinians.
The Balfour Declaration is considered by most Palestinians as the root cause of their suffering under the Israeli occupation. They also blame England for their plight. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
People in the Gaza Strip held a demonstration in front of the Red Cross office in the Gaza Strip to express solidarity with Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails who are on hunger strike in protest to their harsh conditions. 7 Palestinian inmates are in a critical condition due to their hunger strike against the illegal administrative detention practiced against them.
Palestinian inmates have resorted to hunger strike as their last means to defend their rights. Israel's illegal administrative detention must come to an end. We are here to call human rights organizations to pressurize Israel into ending the illegal policy.
In a press conference held during the demonstration, the participants warned against the deteriorating health condition of the prisoners in Israeli jails.
We are here to show our solidarity with our brothers in Israeli jails. To this end, we have gone on a hunger strike to send this message to our brothers that they are not alone in their struggle against Israel. We won't sit back and are ready to pay the price for defending our rights.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails have witnessed heightened pressure over the past years. There are reportedly about 5,000 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons, with a great number of them remaining in jail without any charge.
Supporting our inmates are among our top priorities. We feel duty-bound to defend our brothers with all possible means. To this end, we have organized a number of events to highlight the plight of Palestinian inmates inside Israeli jails.
Israeli authorities keep Palestinian inmates under harsh conditions, from lacking proper hygienic standards to systematic torture. Several Palestinian detainees have been on their hunger strike inside Israeli jails for more than 100 days, protesting their arrest with no charge and the harsh prison conditions. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have begun the hunger strike in solidarity with the prisoners, whose lives are at risk. Eruba Shabbat, Gaza.
The 2nd of November is remembered by Palestinians as a disastrous date in history. It's the 104th anniversary of the so-called Balfour Declaration that pledged on behalf of Britain in 1917 a homeland for the Jewish people in historic Palestine, as every year the Palestinian flag was flown at half-mast mourning this date. Palestinians say the declaration was the first official recognition of the Zionist project by a world power, leading to widespread legitimization of the cause and the eventual establishment of Israel.
Balfour Declaration was one of the worst conspiracies against the Palestinian people. It aimed at depriving us from our right to our homeland, depriving us from our right to have our state, our own state. And it has led to a very severe disaster, which is the ethnic cleansing of about 70% of the Palestinian people in 1948.
The Palestinians are demanding the United Kingdom to apologize for the declaration, and they blame Britain for helping Israel in its occupation of Palestinian territory. But it seems this apology won't happen, Palestinians say, as more world countries harm Palestinians, especially after former U.S. President Donald Trump invented the so-called deal of the century that envisions the Israeli annexation of large swaths of the occupied West Bank. Even after 1 year of his departure, current U.S. President Joe Biden is weak to be able to change Trump's promises to Israel.
Many colonial countries have agreed together to harm the Palestinians and their cause. But our people are still steadfast on our land and dissolve the conspiracies. Trump tried through the so-called deal of the century first to allow Israel annex the West Bank to prevent a Palestinian state on the 1967 lines with its capital at Quds, and never reaching a resolution on the refugees problem. The UK helped Jewish gangs to have a stake on our land, US is supporting them up until the moment.
Palestinians say that the Balfour Declaration has always served as a reminder of the suffering of Palestinians during the decades of Israeli occupation, colonialism, and Judaization.
It has been over a century since the notorious Balfour Declaration. Palestinians today warn that the U.S. support of Israeli encroachment into Palestinian territory is as dangerous as Britain's Balfour Declaration and is definitely helping Israel to prolong its occupation and annex Palestinian land. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
With the socio-economic crisis deepening in Lebanon, the Saudi regime is not making things any easier. Riyadh's reaction to comments by Lebanese Information Minister George Kordahi, who had decried the Saudi war on Yemen, is a stick being used against the Lebanese government. The main question is, will he step down?
Concerning Mr. Kordahi, it is obvious now that he is not going to resign because he is not resembling himself. He is resembling a huge national bloc that is backing him because it's a matter of the Lebanese dignity here. We are not going to let the Saudis succeed in their blackmailing moves against Lebanon.
But analysts believe the Saudi Crown Prince is trying to get concessions from Lebanon in return for funding the economic reform plan.
Saudi Crown Prince is trying to make use of the economic crisis taking place in Lebanon to put pressure on the Lebanese to make some concessions regarding his influence inside Lebanon. And here there is some kind of intersection between the Saudis and the Israelis because the target is the resistance in Lebanon.
Lebanese Foreign Minister Abdullah Bouhabib told Agence France-Presse that he had invited the Saudis to the negotiating table in a bid to solve all the outstanding problems. Saudi Arabia is an Arab country, he said, which has historic brotherly ties with Lebanon, but then severed diplomatic ties without holding any talks. Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati is also holding talks with other Arab states in COP20 in Glasgow to see whether the diplomatic row can be eased. Now, observers say it all has to do with how the Americans deal with the Saudis.
The main issue is between Riyadh and Washington. Once the situation between Washington and Riyadh is solved, I think the crisis will be solved in Lebanon, and the pressure the Saudis are exerting on Lebanon is going to soften. But up till now, it seems that Mikati is having the backing of Washington and Paris, because, as I said, they both want this government to remain.
While the crisis resulting from Minister Kordahi's statements remains high, the Saudis themselves have declared that their campaign against Lebanon is a much bigger issue. Their ultimate goal in the last couple of decades seemed to have been detaching Hezbollah from the Lebanese political scene. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
As Afghanistan is struggling with a wide range of problems, the country's officials warn against the plots hatched by Afghanistan's enemies to wreak further havoc on it. In a conference in the capital, Kabul, Taliban's acting minister of enjoining good and forbidding wrong said that discord has been a big threat to Muslim world even from the very beginning of Islam, adding that one of Afghanistan invaders' goals has been to sow sedition among different Muslim sects in the country.
During the invasion years, the enemies did whatever they wanted in our country. One of their goals was to deepen the differences among our people. This conspiracy has always been used against Muslims throughout history. And if we don't remain united, our enemies will again take control of Afghanistan.
During the conference, Muslim scholars stressed the need for solidarity and tolerance. They added that if Muslims stay aware and united, no one can invade their soil or they don't need to beg foreigners.
Muslim unity should not remain in slogans. People and nations should practically implement it. Islamic governments are obliged to bring Muslims together. Today's critical situation in our country is deeply rooted in the discord created by the Western countries.
We believe that the U.S. and the Zionist regime are trying to weaken Muslims. Westerners are afraid of this.